Welcome to Double X Science, it's in your genes. Today is Monday, July 15th, 2013. I am Adrian Rorick, chemistry editor, and today we have a Beyond the Post interview with Bethany Brookshire, also known as Psycurious. Bethany Brookshire has a BS in biology and a BA in philosophy from the College of William and Mary, a PhD in physiology and pharmacology from Wake Forest University School of Medicine, and recently finished a postdoctoral position at the University of Pennsylvania School of Medicine. She is the guest editor of the Open Laboratory Anthology of Science Blogging 2009 and the winner of the Society for Neuroscience Next Generation Award and the Three Quarks Daily Science Writing Award, among others. She blogs at Scientific American at the Psycurious Brain and at Scientopia at Neurotic Physiology. You can follow her on Twitter as at Psycurious. Good morning, Bethany.
Good morning. Thanks for having me on.
This past week, Double X Science posted your article called Between Neurohype and Neuroskepticism. What was your motivation in writing this post?
Well, I've been thinking about both neurohype and neuroskepticism for a long time. I think many neuroscience writers, and I do tend to specialize in writing about neuroscience, many neuroscience writers, we spend a lot of time talking about how some neuroscience findings get overhyped. So a lot of, you know, this part of your brain is addiction, you know, this part of your brain is going to make you psychotic, you know, all this kind of thing. And, you know, that tends to happen. And it gets on our nerves, and we spend a lot of time trying to fight it, because the brain just isn't that simple. And that's okay. In fact, that's great, because it allows our brain to do the amazing things that they do on a daily basis. But unfortunately, we spend a lot of time fighting this neurohype. Lately, however, there have been a couple of books. So, for example, there have been two different books coming out on neuroskepticism. People in the media have started to pay attention to the fact that neuroscience findings are often overhyped. And so we've had this advent of something called neuroskepticism, which is kind of the opposite of neurohype, pointing a skeptical eye at neuroscience findings. And this is fantastic. You know, a lot of the really skeptical science writers are now getting the attention they deserve. And, it's really important that their work and, you know, their very important skepticism of some of these findings, you know, many of which are, you know, fMRI findings, which can easily be overhyped, and making sure that those receive a critical eye. However, it's possible to go too far in the skeptical toward the skeptical end and just not believe any of it, you know, and then you're like, well, I don't believe any of this silly neuroscience. And, you know, the reality is there's a lot of really good neuroscience out there, and there's a lot of really interesting things that we have learned about the brain. And so I wanted to point out that, you know, there's hype and there's skepticism, but the reality is that science is nuanced, and there is good and there is bad science, and there's good and bad ways of writing about it.
Mm-hmm. Why did you choose Double X Science to post this article?
Partially because I really like getting science information out to women-focused magazines. I think it's really important because there's so many of the magazines that, you know, you'd pick up at the gym, Elle, Marie Claire, things like that. They'd never have a science article in them. And I'm so glad that Double X Science exists and really promotes science to women. Also, I'm always looking for a very intelligent audience that is very curious about science, and Double X Science definitely fits the bill there.
Okay. Do you feel that women are necessarily targeted for some of this neurohype more than other audiences?
Sometimes. It depends on what the hype is. Many times, for example, I think women get overly targeted for things like evolutionary psychology studies, which are badly done. You know, things like the science of women and sex, that's very, very popular. And women get targeted for this stuff. And a lot of the, you know, quote-unquote science that is coming out on this is poorly controlled, not very well done. I actually wrote about a piece on cunnilingus on Friday, which you'd think would be a really female-focused topic. And it was a study done about cunnilingus where they did not ask a single woman anything.
Hmm.
It was a cunnilingus study that focused only on men.
Okay. So moving back to your neuroscience article, for those who don't follow media hype, what are some recent topics of neuroscience hype? And also, conversely, what are some recent topics of neuroskepticism hype? So going too far towards the skeptic end.
Yeah, so one of the things that got me first thinking about this was actually a study that came out a few months ago on beer tasting and dopamine. So dopamine is a neurotransmitter in your brain. So it's a chemical messenger. It communicates between neurons in your brain. And it's one of many different neurotransmitters that's out there. But dopamine is particularly well known for being, you know, linked with things like reward and lust and love and pleasure and things like that. And so the study was the mere taste of beer, just the taste of beer, will increase dopamine in your brain. Everybody stop presses. And that's fine, and it's in fact true. However, this is also really not a surprise at all, partially because we've known for a long time that taste-conditioned cues can increase salience and reward and dopamine. So, for example, most people who start out drinking alcohol do not start out drinking beer. If you were a girl who went to college, you started out drinking what I think we called at our college pica punch. Which is a lot of Kool-Aid and a lot of sugar and a little bit of alcohol because, you know, the taste is not particularly good of, you know, straight alcohol. And then over time, you become conditioned to like the flavor of alcohol because you like the feelings associated with drinking alcohol. And as you like that cue, the taste will begin to activate dopamine and, you know, let you know that you're in for a good time, right?
All right. And
so the fact that the taste of beer activates dopamine is not remotely surprising. But this was splattered all over. This was the biggest, newest study, and it was going to tell us that we were all going to become alcoholics if you, you know, had dopamine responses to beer. And that's not the case at all. It's not. But it was everywhere. It made me very sad, actually.
Yeah. For this, that's a pretty common theme, right? That I find that sometimes you have these studies that come out and they're exactly like you said, these are not a surprise. And then the media get hyped up about them. And then you have people saying, this is what we're spending our science funding on.
Right.
So this becomes, you know, something that comes back in and sort of undercuts science funding in a way, because, you know, drinking beer, of course it makes us feel good and we get this dopamine release due to all the reasons you said, but does it necessarily need to be funded? And I think that some of these need to be funded, but then maybe we don't need to hype them up so much.
Right. I would say, you know, it is an important thing to continue to study. So, for example, how do alcoholics differ in their response to the taste of beer? What about people who don't like beer? The study for beer and dopamine was like, beer activates dopamine. They did not actually test anyone who didn't like beer. It was only people who did.
Well, yeah, that means there was, no control?
No control, no. The control was water. But
okay.
Okay. I think these studies are important. Studies looking at how the brain responds to various compounds can be extremely important, especially for things like the study of alcoholism, which is a significant problem and something that we need to work very hard to understand. But a lot of the findings that get overhyped are of the type that we like to call incremental. There's small advances in the field, and that's great. Does it deserve the front page of the New York Times? Probably not.
Right.
So.
Well, and much of what you say about media coverage of neuroscience applies to all science topics, which you point out as well in this article. Have you written similar articles before calling for balance in media coverage of science?
I have not, but many other people have. And I haven't because, you know, neuroscience is my specialty and I don't really like, it's hard for me to reach out to topics that I don't know anything about. I try to stay away from those. But there are a lot of articles out there. Actually, there's a recent one came out today in Scientific American by Faris Jaber about the recent overhypes in sugar. Because if neuroscience is one place that gets overhyped, nutrition is another. Seems like, it seems like when I was little, I remember it was all like, fat is bad. Fat is really, really, really bad. And then it became, well, fat is good. And then it was, well, certain kinds of fats are bad. And then it was cholesterol is bad. And then it was salt. And then it was, now it's sugar is bad. Mm-hmm. There was a brief time when gluten was bad. And I think that's still going on too.
I agree, yeah.
But now sugar is bad. Sugar is evil.
Well, I think in the 80s, sugar was found to be bad, so they substituted high fructose corn syrup for that.
Right, no.
And then high fructose is bad. But sugar is also still bad, yeah. So...
But the reality is it's never that simple. And so it's really important in all aspects of science that we're careful about what we are reporting, to put it into context, you know, what's been found before, how does this new study compare to those other studies, how well is it done, things like that.
At the end of the post, you point out several neuroscience blogs that people may want to read for the real scoop on neuroscience. Why did you recommend these blogs?
So I recommended the blogs that I recommended, among them Neuroskeptic, Neurocritic, Mind Hacks, Neurobollocks is pretty good. Good name, too.
Exactly.
And other things like that, because they are people who all focus on neuroscience. And they all, most of them spend a lot of time debunking these studies that get a lot of media hype. But they're also, they tend to show a lot of care in the way that they convey the findings. So say, well, you know, this study is, in fact, you know, pretty good. And here is why. And I definitely, there are other blogs out there that don't necessarily focus on neuroscience. So, for example, Ed Young's Not Exactly Rocket Science. It's a really great blog. It focuses on all science in general. And it's great because it explains in basic language why this study is good. What is good about it? What are the not good things about it? Where could they go from here? What does this mean for the field? Those are the kind of blogs and the kind of media coverage. So, for example, Scientific American does a good job with this. That is really important to make sure that people get the right idea about science, because science is a process. Every new scientific finding is in the context of all the other scientific findings before it.
Mm-hmm. So why should XX science readers in particular read these neuroscience blogs that you've mentioned?
Because not only are they careful and, you know, important, they're also very easy to understand. You know, these guys, they're not writing for other scientists. They're writing for, you know, people who maybe aren't scientists. Maybe they're just interested in science. And everyone should be interested in science because science is awesome. But, you know, a lot of times we use jargon and big words and we assume people know the context of what we're talking about. And what's great about a lot of these blogs is that they break it down and they say, okay, we're going to assume you don't know the context, so we're going to give it to you. And it makes it a lot easier to read.
Right. And that's great because, for instance, I'm a chemist, so I don't really know very much about neuroscience, but then I can go to really any of these blogs and find out about neuroscience in a way that I can understand. Are these blogs any way similar to sort of, instead of the journal peer review system, they talk about sort of peer review by blog?
Post-publication peer review is often the phrase that's used. Well, most of the studies that have been published and have been overhyped or not, whatever, all of those usually go through peer review. And there's going to be a panel of, usually it's 2 to 3 scientists, sometimes it's up to 5, who anonymously review a paper and say, okay, you know, here's where your experiments are good, here's where they need improvement, you know, this journal is totally not going to take it, or we will take it if you do these extra experiments, or this paper is great and we'll take it if you correct this grammatical mistake and that which distinction on page 5. Things like that. And that's a really great process, but the reviewers cannot really control how the media takes up the study. And so what I like about blogs and the way that I like to use them is to help get the good science out to the public and also be able to say, hey, 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 wait, that thing that made the Daily Mail, that's not so great, and you should really be careful. So it kind of helps blogs both can critique a study for the public, and they can also help push good science forward.
Okay. Do you find that studies published in certain journals, such as Science or Nature, tend to be hyped more than studies published in neuroscience or another neuroscience journal?
There's also a J Neuroscience. There's also a Neurophysiology, and there's a whole list of them. Neuropsychopharmacology, not to be confused with Neuropharmacology and Psychopharmacology. All different journals.
Nice.
Yeah, a lot of them.
Okay.
I mean, it kind of depends. I think that a lot of the findings in the big journals can sometimes get overhyped because they're bigger findings. You know, it's a high impact journal. People tend to go there with their best stuff. Nature and Science pride themselves on taking what they consider to be the best stuff. And so sometimes that tends to be overhyped. The other thing that I think tends to get overhyped, regardless of journal, is studies with humans in them. So any study with, for example, fMRI, functional magnetic resonance imaging, which creates those really pretty brain photos of the colors in the brain. And they're really pretty. I'm not going to lie. I like them. But they can often be overhyped because a lot of those studies show correlations between activity in the brain and the specific behavior. And usually the studies themselves are pretty cautious and say, well, we found a correlation. Okay, and that's what we found. But often some media outlets will take it and go, oh, man, this correlation, obviously this means that, you know, a large amygdala makes you less likely to be a psychopath or something. A lot of those human studies, because they have more human interest, can tend to be overhyped.
I see. Well, and the other thing to think about, I'd say, with science and nature particularly, is these are not only top journals, but they also have their own media machine.
Yes.
And so, for instance, I get press releases from them that I don't know that a lot of these other smaller journals really give. I know, for instance, in my own field of chemistry, the American Chemical Society also has a media machine, but they have, I don't know, 20 journals or something, and they don't go through every article the same way as I can get a distillation of every single article in Science every
week. Right, right. That's definitely part of it, yeah.
You also wrote in the inaugural post to appear after the XX Science site changed to its new format called, "If You Try One Detox This Year, Make It This One." That article was written in the mindset of everyone's New Year's resolutions to conform to the cultural expectations of women's bodies set out in women's magazines such as Glamour, Shape. You go over many claims made by detox diets and point out why they're wrong. What was the motivation to write that post?
Well, I was so pleased that I got to write one of the inaugural pieces on XX Science. It was a really great experience, and I'm so glad that I was able to do that. And I also was glad that I was able to talk about the issues with some of the detox diets, because I am subject to all of the societal pressures that every other woman in America is subject to. New Year's comes around, my pants don't fit, you know, you got to go to the gym. Yeah. Gym involves sweat. Sweat is hard. And it involves time. And you pick up these magazines, and the magazines are glossy, and they're pretty, and they have, you know, the latest fashions in them, and you want to read them. And then you feel terrible about yourself because they're full of these, you know, carefully photoshopped perfect bodies that very few people have, but that we're all pressured to have. And then they're full of these secrets.
In the case of the Photoshop bodies, really nobody has, because
yes.
Even these beautiful, perfect models have been photoshopped for some crazy idea.
Right. Yeah, and it's hard to see that and then see those detox diets, and there's this little whisper, you could be like that if you lived on lemon juice and cabbage soup for 30 days and nothing else.
Right.
You know, and it's hard to fight that. I have studied physiology, and I carefully pride myself on being a really logical person and trying not to give in to that stuff, and I feel it. Mm-hmm. And if I feel it, I'm sure lots of other people do. My motivation for it was, you know what? Ladies, let us band together and fight this, because it's stupid, and we all know better.
Actually, in some ways, this goes back to the field of nutrition being overhyped, mm-hmm. right? And this is the overhype of these diets that always promote that they're the next best thing, right? And they're going to make you healthy in this way, or they're going to make you skinny in that way. And
right, yeah, and it's just, I find it so frustrating how those messages are just consistently pushed to women. You know, you'll never see, you know, Sports Illustrated telling dudes to eat kale. It's just not going to happen. You know, it's pushed to women because women are, you know, forced to consume these stereotypes of what we're supposed to look like. And I think it's time we stopped eating it up.
Yep. On the other hand, to be fair, I think some things like Sports Illustrated may push the steroid
yes.
abuse by more men. So, but, you know, both have major health considerations, and I do feel that women are very targeted by all these magazines, and really any magazine, because even the ones geared towards men have these beautiful women in them, and even ones that are sort of gender neutral, mm-hmm. you know, the ads or even the pictures that are associated with the stories, they have sort of regular looking guys, but often super thin, beautiful women.
Right. Yeah. No, I mean, men feel, I think, a lot of the same pressure. And I think that actually men are starting to feel more and more of that pressure as, you know, some of those media machines get underway. Men's fitness is pretty bad like that. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I think that, you know, no matter where you go, you can't escape the view that a woman needs to look a certain way. And that's really not cool. It's not good for us.
Yeah. So for either of these articles, is there anything else you'd like to share?
Don't necessarily go too far toward the neuroskepticism. You know, it's easy to sit there and go, oh, you know, if this one study was bad, they're all bad, you know, and you get really jaded. And, you know, sometimes I have to fight being jaded too. But really, there's good science out there. A lot of it is very good. A lot of it is written about very well. And science is well worth looking at. It's well worth reading. It's interesting stuff, and it can tell us a lot about the human body. It can tell us a lot about the human brain. So I have hopes that neuroscience will not suffer too much for either neurohype or neuroskepticism in the long run.
I think there are a lot of prominent bloggers in the field of neuroscience. I can think of several off the top of my head, in addition to the ones you mentioned in your article. And so I think that if we make sure that any article we read in the New York Times is followed up by perhaps one of these blogs, we might get a little bit of balance.
Yeah, I think balance is out there. You just got to find it.
Yep, exactly. So you can find both these posts discussed today at our website, xxscience.org, and I'll include the links to the posts in the show notes. The neuroscience one is currently up on our main page. Thank you for recording with me today, Bethany.
Thank you very much for having me on.
And thank you for listening. Please subscribe to our podcast via iTunes or your favorite podcatcher. If you are enjoying the podcast, please rate our podcast and leave us a review at iTunes to help bring science to more people. Our music is provided by Editor-in-Chief Emily Willingham. Please like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at XXI. This has been Chemistry Editor Adrian Rorick, and this is XX Science, bringing science to the woman in you.